your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, that would be me. Glad to step up to the plate here on, oh my gosh, what a beautiful Sunday it is here on Memorial Weekend. I hope those of you who are enjoying it will also take a moment and remember what it's for. My maternal grandfather actually was a participant in World War II, so I thank him, and I hope the rest of you will take a moment and thank others for their support and their duties. So a beautiful Sunday here. I think it's the 24th. Is that right, Rusty Simpreg? Sure. I left you hanging earlier. Thank you. The 24th of May seems a little early for Memorial Day, but so it is. Thanks for those of you who are listening, maybe down in Lynchburg's 89.9. And let me take a moment and thank 4-5 Fix for their support. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 4-5-Fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates, available anytime. It's the number 4 and the number 5 and the word fix.com. All right. Rusty was right. It's going to be an interesting program today. I think we have a little bit, a little mix of education and opinion here for the hour. Let me fire up the microphones and introduce the guest, Dayton Haw. Dayton, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for spending your beautiful Sunday of Memorial Weekend with us. Dayton is the chief of the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad for 16 years. Is that right?
That's about right.
I went back and brought up my files, did my learning for the program since 1994.
Yes, I've aged considerably since then.
Have you?
Yes.
I hope that's not a sign on me because you look a little younger and I don't feel that old. And for those who don't know, we'll refer to this program, Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad, short known as CARS.
Right.
C-A-R-S. Busiest all-volunteer rescue squad in the country. Is that still true?
Well, probably so, yes. Of the people that submit their data every so often, that tends to be correct. Other people run more calls, but they also consolidate a number of different stations into one.
So does that make CARS, the rescue squad, one of the best? Or does that make Charlottesville, Albemarle, et cetera, one of the dumbest and, you know, people who hurt themselves more than any other place?
I don't know what it makes it. I don't know that it makes us anything other than busy.
All right. Dayton's here. We're going to spend some time talking about how the system works. But for those of you who, you know, who read more than the first paragraph in the paper, who go online to get updated on some of the local news, there's been a lot in the past year or so about CARS, Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad, and how they do work and how things might be better, according to some people, local politicians, and others in our area. So let's start at the top, Dayton.
Okay.
Dayton being the chief of the rescue squad. How does a volunteer system work? You know, are there paid people? Who's in charge of all this, et cetera?
Okay, I can speak to CARS. CARS is a independent 501c3 nonprofit organization that provides service to the city and the county and the university. CARS itself does not have any paid personnel. About 3 or 4 years ago, we entered into an agreement with Albemarle County to have some of their paid medics come down for the purpose of being precepted. In other words, they had experienced personnel. They had hired some people that they wanted to become medics released to practice in their system. So we entered into an agreement so that Monday through Thursday, they would have a medic down there, and they would send people down and have them precepted by that medic. And it worked out pretty well, and it was a little confusing to have it done 4 days out of the week. So at some point, we entered into an agreement with the county so that they would have 2 medics down there. They would still perform precepting functions for both their people and our people. So now out of 98 12-hour shifts that I have to fill for minimum staffing every week, the county paid personnel fill 10 of those, and our volunteers fill 88 of the remaining.
All right.
Does that make sense?
What is precepting?
Precepting is where an inexperienced or a less inexperienced person in this system rides along on calls under the supervision of a more experienced person or a person that is from this system. So you could take an experienced paramedic from Los Angeles, have them come into the system. There's usually a little bit different equipment, sometimes different protocols that they have to learn. And then they are examined by their medical director to be released to practice on their own.
So it's really, it sounds to me, whether, you know, this comes from like bad cop movies or something, but it sounds like where, you know, a police station where the rookie gets put with the senior guy.
With the field training officer, exactly.
All right. And so how do you do that? I mean, you made your own comment about it being difficult for just 4 days out of the week. But in the beginning, how did you do that for, with just two guys or two people? Because there are, what's the percentage of females involved in cars?
Oh, probably about 50%.
Wow.
We're
so
pretty diverse.
I'll stop saying guys then.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you do that for, did everybody have to go through this program where the I guess where these are two professionally trained people?
Well, they're pretty much two similar systems.
The
volunteers,
professionally paid people?
Yes. They're actually two systems because the volunteers have to go through a precepting process also. We just don't take people that come in and have an EMT card and throw them on a truck. They've got to be precepted by our senior personnel as well. So the people specifically being precepted by the county personnel are other county employees that are recent hires or transfers or have upgraded their EMS certification. But we also, everybody at CARS has to be precepted by the equivalent of a field training officer before they can touch someone.
How many people are we talking about?
We have about 170 members.
So did all 170 members have to go on the truck with these two people at some point?
No, not with those two people, but with other people that were also preceptors.
So yes, why did the county send these two?
Well, we're very busy, and they have other places, like they've staffed an ambulance at Scottsville, but they run 1 or 2 days in Scottsville. It takes them forever to get the patient contacts, the number of patient contacts necessary to be able to be released. So we were in sort of a mutually advantageous agreement. We're busy, they're busy. They like to come down to a busy system so that they can have an increased number of patient contacts so that they can accomplish what they need to accomplish and then be released to practice.
So it's really, it's like any job where the more hours you put in, the faster you're considered to be fully trained.
Right. Well, the more opportunity you have to do the skills that you need to do, the faster you'll be up to speed.
We are talking with Dayton Haw here from the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad. Dayton, you talk about the two, what's the proper term, fully trained, the two people from the county. Two medics that the county said, we would like you to put these two in. Were they forced upon you?
No.
No.
Absolutely
not. You said, excellent. We would love to have two more, you know, well-trained, excellent, up-to-date people on the staff.
Sure. I met with the medical director. We'd been talking about it for a couple years probably, and they had a class to upgrade the certification of some of their people, and they needed to have an opportunity for them to have supervised contact with patients on an ambulance so they could get released. And that's when the agreement was first signed, and that's when our arrangement started.
Do you have any other paid staff members?
No.
I mean, you're the chief. Are you paid?
No.
This is not your full-time, you know,
daily
paid job.
I'm not sure you can pay me enough to do it.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure you could pay me enough to go on one trip. What are the pros and cons about, you know, having a volunteer system versus, I would assume that there are other areas in the state of Virginia alone, you know, whether you went to Richmond, whether you went to I don't know, Fredericksburg or whether you went to Orange County. I don't know how these places work, but I would assume that there are other cities and counties in the state of Virginia that are pretty much fully paid personnel.
Yes.
So what are the pros and cons of volunteer versus paid?
In general, the strengths of the volunteer community tend to be that you have community members that are familiar with the community. They give you a little bit of contact with the people that live there. They also give you a little bit of a surge capacity. And by surge capacity, I mean that if you were, and I'm not inviting this, but if you were to have a plane crash and you need everybody that you can get your hands on that's trained and able to respond to such a plane crash, that you have people that are members that are also living in the community that can respond to help in a relatively timely fashion. And I think that's one of the strengths of the community. The other is that we have a very diverse membership. We have physicians, we have lawyers, we have engineers, we have people from all walks of life, young people, more young people than older people. But we have young people, we have old people, we have a mix of ethnicity, and it just makes a very vibrant group.
How many, what number, percentage, et cetera, come from the university student area? You mentioned having a very young group.
We have probably a quarter to a third at any given time. And then we have people that went to UVA and graduated and stayed in the area and became nurses or got jobs in the area that continued to volunteer with CARS.
You know, one of the things that caught me off guard doing my research for the show, this is Dayton Hoff, chief of the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad since 1994. And that was something that I found interesting was everybody seemed to do it for 2 years. Those people who did it in a repeated process, did it for two, took a year or two off, came back. And then you run into Dayton every year for this super long stretch. So I figured either that you were really, really good or, just not quite up to speed on when you'd done enough.
I didn't get out of the room fast enough.
Right.
Yes.
You know, you were always the guy who they said, well, Dayton's not here tonight. Let's volunteer him. Yay, we got enough votes. Charlottesville, and I assume that this applies to Albemarle County as well, the fire department is a separate unit and system from the rescue squad. Is that why, and is that true for the average area in the state?
I would say probably so. And it's probably so because EMS, Emergency Medical Services, as a profession, if you want to call it a profession, is very young. And it didn't come about until the 1960s, whereas you've had fire departments since Benjamin Franklin was alive. And so most localities have had some sort of fire department for hundreds of years. They've always had some method to put out people's houses that were on fire. And since EMS is a relatively young profession, they tended to start separately. And only in the last probably 15 or 20 years have the fire services gotten interested in EMS. And most of the places you'll find now at least do some sort of fire first response to EMS calls. And by that I mean that if you call the 911 center and they determine the type of call, they have medical approved protocols. They'll look at what your complaint is, and if there's a fire engine that's closer than an ambulance for certain types of calls, they'll send that fire engine with EMS trained personnel and equipment on it to get there first, and hopefully will improve your ability to recover. And
right, fastest response.
That's right. That's right.
Whoever can get there first for the
more serious calls.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I remember the first time that happened. I'm like, why are they sending a fire truck?
I get that question very frequently. Yes. And they're sending it because whatever the call was to the 911 center fit into a dispatch protocol that called for a fire first response.
And what you mean by that is that was something that somebody at the firehouse was trained to do, and so they could get there first, because it doesn't stop somebody from the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad from arriving.
No.
The fire truck gets there first because they're closest. Somebody on the truck is trained to at least start handling the situation, even if they don't know 100%. They know the basic, you know, beginner's part of the response.
Right.
And then the ambulance shows up to, do you nudge them out of the way and say, hey, we're here now, step aside?
They would say probably that does happen, and I would hope to say that it doesn't happen. But I think probably people get tunnel vision and they do feel that they're edged out of the way sometimes. But you have to understand that in order to be a first responder, a fire department has to be a licensed EMS agency, licensed by the Office of Emergency Medical Services under the Department of Health, just like we are. They're just not licensed frequently as a transport agency. So there is a minimum level of EMS certification and training that they have to be able to be a licensed first responder agency in Virginia.
All right, back up a minute.
Okay.
They're not licensed to be a transporter?
There's a difference. There's different equipment that you have to have. So they don't have to have an ambulance. If they're going to ever set foot on the ambulance to accompany the ambulance to the hospital, then they need a transport license. So the Seminole Trail has a transport license, even though Seminole Trail itself doesn't have an ambulance. Charlottesville Fire Department has a transport license, even though they don't have an ambulance.
What do you need to have a transport license? I mean, you
said
certain
state rules and regulations, so you've got to have it.
But what does that mean? I mean, what do those departments have, and I assume what do those buildings or those trucks have that somebody in, I live in Earliesville, but Earliesville doesn't have?
Earliesville would not have a truck-mounted suction unit or truck-mounted oxygen tank on it. It also would not be required to have so many pillows and so many blankets on it. And things like that. There's a different equipment list for an ambulance than there is for a first response vehicle that could be a fire engine or it could be a blazer owned by the fire department or a rescue squad.
11:16 on the wake-up call. We're talking with Chief of the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad, Dayton Haw. Feel free to dial up or write down the number. We'll take some calls in a few minutes. 979-0919 is the local number. 1-877 WNRN Rocks is toll-free because this is not just the Charlottesville Albemarle program. There's questions here that go throughout the state and can even be a national setup. So the toll-free folks a little further out in Lovingston or Lynchburg or Harrisonburg, 1-877-WNRN Rocks, and the local folks, 979-0919 with Dayton Haw. So, Dayton, if I understand that correctly, and I understand rules are always put into place for optically a good reason, you know, when you
right.
sit down and you sit in the room with seven people on the committee, they're put into place for what seems to be a good reason at the time. I live in Earliesville, and I have, people who listen to the program know this, and I don't hide this, I have epilepsy. I have a seizure that leads to a much more serious issue, and the Earliesville people get there first.
Right.
But they can't take me to the hospital if that's what's needed.
They can't transport you to the hospital because they don't have an ambulance, for one reason.
But they have the ability. But they have the blazer that says Earliesville Volunteer Fire Department on the side.
Yeah, that doesn't meet the standards for patient transport.
And I understand that. It doesn't meet the standards. But if, you know, if I was needed to be transported as quickly and as soon as possible because that seizure had led to something much more dramatic and serious, they might have to just do their best to keep me, you know, as safe and healthy as possible for five more minutes
right.
until a real licensed transporter could get there.
Or they would fly you out.
Or they would fly me out.
Not personally, they would call Pegasus, probably. They don't have a helicopter either, but they would probably call Pegasus. And, of course, the ambulance that would come to Earliesville, depending on where you are, would probably be the ambulance, the career-staffed ambulance from Hollymead, the one that the county has at the Hollymead Fire Station.
Okay. It just seems like that sometimes that may not be, that may be a rule worth breaking, but
well,
that's never going to be broken
let's
for
say
fear
this.
Something else happens.
If they were to break that rule and they could justify it to the Department of Health, it would be okay.
All right.
The Office of EMS would investigate that, and if they could justify a reason why they transported you from someplace to someplace else because it absolutely had to be done, and I think that probably the investigatory personnel would be okay with
it. Or it's
that.
One of those things where they're like, okay, you know that that's the rule, but this time it was okay, but don't assume that that makes it always okay.
Right. It would have to be a very unusual circumstance before that would happen, because there are a certain number of things that have to be done immediately that take a few minutes, no matter who gets there. So you're going to have your airway open. You're going to have to be put on oxygen. You're going to have to perhaps be ventilated. They may have to start CPR. They might have to use their AED, their automatic external defibrillator, if your heart's not beating. And those are things that have to be done no matter where you are by anybody that has that equipment, and it's not related to the ultimate transport.
11:19 here in the wake-up call with Chief of the local rescue squad, Dayton Haw. Dial us up. Ask a question if you have one. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Ian's here today to answer the phone and patch you through. Let me give you the weather. When we come back, we're going to start talking about some of the changes possible or certainly have been discussed between the rescue squad's relationship with Charlottesville and Albemarle County. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley mostly cloudy, 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms today, highs in the upper 70s, mid-80s in Richmond, cloudy with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, lows in the low 60s, then mostly cloudy, 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, highs in the mid-70s. Lower 80s again in Richmond. Right now, there's clouds across the listening area, 79 in the valley, 71 in Lynchburg, 72 in Richmond, and a beautiful 71 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank Irish Alley Restaurant and Pub for their support today. They serve a variety of cuisine for lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch in downtown Stanton. You can dine inside or on the outdoor patio. Irish Alley also features a selection of local beer. They can handle private parties of up to 40 at Irish Alley, a non-smoking establishment across from the Byers Street parking lot in Stanton. For more, it's golookon.com. And with the weather being so nice, WNRN wants to remind you that Fry's Spring Beach Club in Charlottesville is now accepting memberships for the summer of 2009. At Fry's Springs, you'll find a 50-foot meter lap pool. That makes no sense. It's not 50-foot meter. It's just 50-meter lap pool, mid-size recreation pool, and a baby pool with a swim team for kids 4 to 18. Also at Fry's Springs, it's tennis and volleyball, swings and slides, and acres of fun right in the city. What's behind the fence at JPA and Old Lynchburg Road in Charlottesville? It's busy children, lazy moments, and your summer vacation. More at fsbc.net. That's Fry Springs Beach Club.net. All right, back with Dayton Haw here in the studio. Dayton, I asked the question about being nudged out of place, et cetera. How does it work when there are different jurisdictions at the same scene?
Everybody in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and the university is covered by a unified incident management system policy adopted by the 911 Center Management Board, which means that we have an incident command system that is instituted at the scene of all calls. So if we have a major fire in the city or the county, it's likely that the other jurisdiction will need to come and assist in some way. On the fire ground or on the scene of a big medical call, we know that there will be someone considered to be the incident commander. There will be somebody that's in charge of operations. There will be somebody that's in charge of rescue or extrication or triage or treatment or being a rapid intervention team if it's a structure fire, those kinds of things. So there is it started way back when in the big forest fires in California, incident command system. And now it's been adopted nationwide. It's part of the things that you have to have in place in order to get federal funding from FEMA.
How do you determine who's the guy in charge? I mean, you said that there's did you say incident commander?
There is an incident commander. Yes, there's somebody that is in charge of managing. It is, technically, it's the first senior person to get there on the first arriving piece of apparatus until they're relieved by somebody else. And it could be a higher-ranking person from the fire department that gets there. It could just be somebody else, a more experienced person from the rescue squad that gets there to relieve them. So it falls upon the shoulders of the first person to get there to start setting up the incident management system.
Is there any, you know, and I realize I asked this question, you're on air, I would assume sure. that there are other volunteers and maybe a paid professional or two, a city or a county administrator of some sort listening. Are there instances of people getting their nose bent out of shape because you've got one, two, three, maybe if it happens at the university because they have their own police system, maybe four different jurisdictions participating?
I have to honestly say no, I don't think so. I don't think I've never seen that here.
So, you know, you can honestly say that the focus is on solving the problem, more about who's in charge.
Yes.
Excellent. Good to know. I guess that's one of the reasons why it's such a successful rescue squad, at least.
And I just can't think of any time where there's been a disagreement as to who should be in charge of something. Just can't think of a time. There may be a time, but I can't think of a time.
All right. Dayton Haw here from the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad. Let's start in on the topic of how the systems work. Because for people who read the paper or follow the news online or whatever your method is, Charlottesville had some serious conversation about putting in their own EMS system.
Their own transport unit.
Their own transport.
They're already a first responder system, so they already do fire first response. And I think
what's the difference between having your own transport unit from your own EMS system? I mean, you told me that you have to meet the certain rules,
right?
But overall, what's the difference? Does that just make every fire department qualified? Is that all that is?
I'm not sure it makes every fire department qualified, but the difference between a first response agency and a transport agency is pretty striking, although you wouldn't think it to be so. If you're a first responder agency, you know you're going to run so many calls a year, and you know that it's going to take you, on average, about this much time to clear from each call. For a first response medical call from a fire department in the city, it's probably going to take you 15 or 20 minutes to turn that engine from being out of service back into service. For a transport unit in the city and the urban ring, it's probably going to take us 55 minutes to 60 minutes to turn that unit around and get it back into service. So one of the things you have to calculate is the number of calls you have, the number of available units you have, and how long they're going to be out of service. That's
so
one of the things.
Back-to-back calls are bad things.
Oh, they can be. They can be, yes. You have to staff accordingly. And the other thing is that you have different sets of equipment that you have to worry about if you're doing transport. It's sort of a different environment when you're the one that's responsible, not for just going and providing the initial care. And sometimes it's life-saving care. There's no doubt about it. The first person gets there with an AED for somebody in cardiac arrest, no matter who it is, be a police officer with an AED, may be the difference between recovery and not recovery. So it can certainly be life-saving care, but there's the difference between getting there and doing a certain set of skills until the transport unit arrives and then transports a patient than there is for being responsible for the patient from the A all the way through Z.
But my feelings from following the topic, City of Charlottesville was discussing spending their own $750,000 in their budget
right.
to make this change.
Yes, and I think you have to go back to the time period where this was occurring. At the time, the city and the county were participating in a fire consolidation study, and they had hired Matrix Consulting to do an evaluation as to whether or not it was feasible for the Charlottesville Fire Department and the Albemarle County Fire Department to merge as one entity, maybe under a board
or something. They can't even merge the Parks and Rec Department.
I can't speak to that, but at any rate, during this period of time, the consultant was looking at things, and the consultant came in and started looking at the data. And before they ever started, they said, I don't care what you tell us. We go to every jurisdiction, and we try to do a study, and we always find out that the data is bad. So they started getting the data, and CARS runs about 12,000 calls a year. The Charlottesville Fire Department runs about 5,500 calls a year. And some of those are in an automatic response district under a contract with Albemarle, so parts of the urban ring are covered by the city fire department.
What you mean is the urban ring, like for people who aren't aware, the city of Charlottesville border is right at 29 and Hydraulic Road.
Right.
So if the call came from one of those apartment complexes just over on the other side of Hydraulic, close to Albemarle High School.
Well, probably the better example would be where your studio is. The Station 10 for the city is in the county next to the University Police Department and the 911 Center. So we had a call here. The engine from that place would come here.
Even though it's a county.
Even though this is in the county and it is a county call, it's a part of the area where they're closest, and under the contract, they'll come here.
Okay.
So that was one of the things they were looking at. And they realized that, well, you know, CARS is running all these calls, and we started looking at the data, and the data that they were finding for response times was pretty questionable. And so everyone started looking at that, and then they thought, oh, well, gee, some of these calls, they look terrible. And one of the examples I remember clearly was, well, it took them 30 or 45 minutes to get to a stabbing on Maury Avenue. What they forgot to tell you was that, well, the patient had left the scene. And they were wandering around someplace. So it didn't take them 30 or 45 minutes to get there. It took them 45 minutes for somebody to locate the patient who had wandered blocks away. But that's the kind of thing that started to come up. Also in that period of time, with the building of Hollymead Town Center, the county, we had approached the county and said, look, you've got a 20-lane roadway going into a 2-lane roadway that's going into a 6-lane roadway that's ending up at a major shopping place where you have, I don't know, 7 or 14 restaurants, and you've got all these housing units, and we just simply can't cover that area in a timely fashion. So that's the point at which the county had determined that they would go ahead and staff an ambulance up there, and maybe an engine, too. I can't remember at the time.
That's the one on Airport Road?
That's the one on Airport Road now that they built the firehouse just off Airport Road. For a while, they were in the Amvest terminal. They had rented that. And that's also the time period where we had increased the precepting to a more formal agreement that was 5 days a week with two people down there. So we had done a number of different things that all hit at the same time. And then, I guess as time went by, and we started getting better data from the CAD system, from the commuter aided dispatch system, better response time information in the city, it just, well, you know, we're actually above 90% in 9 minutes in the city, which in most places in the county, if you have a system that's contracted to do it, you're receiving bonuses from the government for being in that area.
But did the city drop this concept of putting in their own, and I read 750,000, and somewhere else right. I read a million, but somewhere in that dollar figure, because of budget, because of numbers proving the idea to be wrong, or there was a lot of negative feedback from the rescue squad itself saying, what are you doing? Stop. This is not true. We can do it. You know,
well, it came from the public. It came from us, too, but it came from the public, too. Oh, and I forgot to mention that about this time, the county decided to put a career-staffed ambulance at the Monticello station that's on Mill Creek Drive just south of the city. So we'd done some studies as to the number of calls that came in, and you can use a formula. You can go through and see how many ambulances you need in a system for a certain number of calls, and they did that. And once they put that ambulance at Mill Creek, it It gave you your basically your fourth urban ambulance that was the number that Matrix had come up with. Actually, they said 3.5 because there's a peak period. But because of various and sundry different shifts and things, it, we now have 4. If that makes any sense, and it probably doesn't. Understand that it's confusing and so detail oriented, and there's so many things that go into.
Well, it's like everything else in terms of efficiency, right. It's all number driven.
Right
now, I mean, at least now,
sure.
You go to Richmond. Culture.
You go to Richmond. Richmond did contract with Mercy Ambulance. They have a Richmond Ambulance Authority. They contracted with a provider, and the provider did non-emergency transport. That's to
Does
and
that
from
mean
doctors.
That they're private?
Were pseudo-private, but they really operated under the auspices of the government under the Richmond Ambulance
Authority. Let me interrupt here for a second, because CARS, the Charlottesville Albemarle, does not charge for
That's
services.
Right. That's
if
right.
they show up, if they, you know, whatever to do, whether you're having an epilepsy seizure, whether right. you're having a heart attack, whether you, you know, broke your toe and it's bleeding all over the place and, you know, all you really need to have is stitches.
Right.
There's no charge to whom you show up to help.
That's right.
Even if they take you to Martha Jefferson or University Emergency Room.
Right. No, that's right.
But if some of these other ambulances that we see with, and I want to ask you to mention a name because I can't think of any.
Lifeline, Life Care. They're the considered the private commercial
they do
priority
charge you.
And medical transport.
Do you have to call them out of your house?
Well, I'm not sure they would come to your house. Maybe they would. If you're doing a routine admission from your house to some floor at Martha Jefferson or to the VA hospital in Richmond, then yes, you could call them and arrange for them to transport you because, of course, we're not going to take you to the VA hospital. It's a little bit outside of our mission to do that.
Understood.
Right.
So you will receive a bill from them?
From them, yes.
Yes, but not from you?
Not from us.
Okay. No. And so back
that's
to the Richmond topic, when you say that but. Richmond had a, I think you used the word pseudo-contract
well,
with Mercy?
They had a real contract, but okay. it was pseudo-governmental because okay. it's through the ambulance authority. And I think what they did was that they know they're going to do so many transfers from a nursing home to a hospital and back in a day. They know they're going to get so many 911 calls, and you can look any place in the country, and the graph of 911 calls varies by the hour of the day. It sort of, you know, goes down after midnight, and then it starts picking up from 9 o'clock, and then peaks up, and then it goes back down. So they can calculate how many ambulances they need to have staffed at a given time, and this, so that's what they do. And you take a place like that, they may have 30 ambulances staffed at noon. They may go down to 20 ambulances at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or 10 ambulances at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's just some of the calculations that go into when you're a private contracted firm to do things like
but
that.
But that's just personnel, right? Because yeah. you can have 20 ambulances.
Sure. Oh, you've got
that doesn't mean you have 40 people or
right.
3 people on an ambulance, 2 people?
Two. Minimum of 2.
All right.
So we have 8 ambulances, but they're not staffed all the time. But because we have a little surge capacity, if I leave here today and they get really busy, I can run down there and get on one of the ambulances that's there.
Do you have different protocol? Do you have different required methods of doing things when you have a call to the city as opposed to the county?
No.
No.
We don't. No.
So there's no...
Pretty much all the standard scene operation things are about the same in the city and the county, I think, it's particularly for EMS. Now, there may be a couple differences for certain fire things in the city and the county. For one thing, the city on a structure fire is always going to have a ladder truck that's going to be along with the call, so they may have certain things that are built into their initial arriving instructions that may not be in certain places in the county that don't have a truck.
There's something... an organization that's meeting now to discuss possible changes, if I understand properly, the Fire Rescue Ordinance Advisory Committee.
Yes.
Well, what is that and what's its purpose?
Well, its purpose was, and I sit on that, and I was an unwilling participant in that. I sat on it because my board told me I had to sit on it. was to accept the charge from the county to go write us an ordinance. This is what kind of ordinance it's going to be. Write it and send it back. So that was its charge. We're going to have a fire chief in charge.
About what?
We want you to, about how fire and EMS are handled within the county government, I guess.
And that's needed for what purpose? Because if you say that the city and the county already have the same protocol for cars to show up and do what's needed to be done.
Yeah, it's not just cars. It was for the entire system, all the 10 volunteer companies in the county and the career staff
and
stations.
What problem or potential problem led to the requirement or the need for this?
I'm glad you asked that. I asked that same question a number of times. I've just met with a number of people on the Board of Supervisors and said, what problem is it that you're trying to solve? Because they would ask the question, well, you eliminate the flowery language. It's about a page long. What's wrong with it? And I'm like, well, what is it that you want it to do? What problem are you trying to solve? Then I'll tell you whether or not this ordinance will do it. Because normal problem-solving behavior is you identify the problems. This is just typical management. Any high school management class. Identify the problem, identify potential solutions, select one, implement it, reevaluate, and go back to the beginning. Okay, it's like that. It's a circle, you know, or a square, however you want to do it. And I got some interesting responses, and I'll give you an example of one. We would sit in the ordinance meetings, and Doug Smithers, the chief of Seminole Trail, was the other volunteer representative on this meeting, on this committee. And one of the examples was, well, we've been insuring vehicles we haven't owned in 5 years. I'm like, really? Well, we get a list every year, and it would seem to me that every time we look at that list, we would strike something, and 5 years goes by, we'd be struck by now. But okay, let's assume that that's true. It's possible. What's your solution to it? You've passed this ordinance. You're in charge. You can do anything you want to. What are you going to do about it? Well, I guess we'll write a policy. Well, you could write a policy now, you know, if you wanted to.
Yes, the policy is let's not insure vehicles we don't own anymore.
Right.
I mean, I would do that at my house.
Right. Well, my solution was not write a policy because I'm not a bureaucrat.
Just do it.
No, I was like, okay, so we meet every month anyway, and you send out a packet every month. Print off the same list that you give us once a year now, print it off every month and send it out. So we got to the ACFRAB, the Albemarle County Fire Rescue Advisory Board meeting, the next month, and the assistant chief mentioned something about insuring vehicles, and I said, again, why don't you, next month, just print out for everybody what's insured so we can look at it. We'll look at it every month. If there's something on there that shouldn't be, we'll strike it off immediately. Okay, so the next month, we got to the ACFRAB meeting, and I raised my hand. Nothing was mentioned about it. There wasn't anything in the packet. I raised my hand, and I said, what became of my suggestion that we're going to print off these? Well, we resolved that. That's not a problem, and I just want to let you know cars didn't have any vehicles that were involved in that. And that was the end of it. All right, that's one problem. Another problem was there was an incident on the interstate. I'll call incident on the interstate because I don't know all there is to know about it. Some water was released from a water tanker from one of the fire departments. It froze over. I think there was an accident that resulted from that. And the complaint was that nobody had notified the county staff that that had occurred. Well, it turned out that they had notified somebody in the county staff. It just hadn't gotten up to whatever level this person was that didn't know anything about it. So to get back to your question, what problem we're trying to solve is, it's very unclear, and I've asked the Board of Supervisors, what problem are you trying to solve? And they seem to separate out some of the administrative functions from the on-scene operations, and they want somebody that will be able to make administrative decisions, but I'm not sure what they are or what decisions are not being made now that they want to have made. And I think that's one of the reasons that you saw the board a little reticent to go forward with a scheduled public hearing that they had for last month is because they looked at it and said, well, gee, maybe we really haven't defined this very well.
Yeah, the minutes that I looked into for in preparation for today's program had a lot of, well, let's change the and to possibly, or, you know, it was a lot of, I think you said flowery language.
Right.
There was a lot of grammatics. Is that the proper term? Semantics.
Yes.
That were, that it seemed to be quite some time spent with.
Yes, right. Quite a lot of time, to be exact.
11:44 here in the wake-up call with Dayton Haw as we talk about the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad. Now we're talking about some of the potential changes in the current structure, whether that happens because Cars request it or whether that happens because the city and county are rethinking some of
their... this would be the county, not the city. I think right this minute the city is...
City spent last year talking about that.
With the way things are going now.
All right, 11:44 here on the Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, The Hook goes road tripping and shows us some interesting places along the way. Ever been to a minor league ball game? Played the longest golf hole in the world, been kissed by a camel. All this and more, just a car ride away. Area builder Jack Stoner takes the interview hot seat. He has constructed beautiful homes all over Central Virginia, but his favorite work is done worldwide through his nonprofit, Building Goodness. And is it possible that being thin but lazy is more unhealthy than being overweight but active? Read about it in The Hook. The Hook, showing us all that kissing a camel can be a fun summer day. And support for WNRN coming from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, encouraging you to discover the outdoor adventures right on your doorstep at area, state, and national park. The staff at your local Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can help you with camping supplies, maps, guides, and even suggestions for excursions. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville at Wintergreen, and on West Broad Street and the Chesterfield Town Center in Richmond. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because at noon, Patrick is here for Les Temps Purdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. There will be no Michael Jackson, no Tiffany, but you will hear Dead Kennedys, Depeche Mode, and Poe. Request always welcome. That's Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music and Basil. That's right, noon, it's Patrick. I haven't seen Patrick since a fundraiser, although that's really not as far away as I wish that it was. 11:46 on the wake-up call. Dayton Haw here in the studio. 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. WNRN Studio at the AOL instant message. Dayton, here's an instant message that came in for us. If the county is rethinking its fire structure, where do things stand now?
I use the suggestion that the ordinance was aging, but unlike fine wine or cheese, it wasn't getting any better. So I think right this minute is we need to go back to a process where we identify problems that we want to solve. And that was my suggestion to Dennis Rooker when I met with him with a group of people from the other rescue squads, is that let's go back and to a process that had begun but was ended, and go and identify these problems and potential solutions and bring them forward to the Board of Supervisors.
All right, if the politicians aren't announcing what these problems are, because it sounded like from our conversation a few minutes ago that they are, that the organization, what is it, the Fire Rescue Ordinance Advisory Committee,
right,
has spent a lot of time on flowery language rather than identifying a problem and implementing a solution.
We understand that was our charge. They had already done, our charge was, here's the solution, implement it.
So what solution, what problem was it that needed a solution? And are there other problems that you, as the fire chief of the area rescue squad, might you see that have not been attacked yet?
Well, the problems were not passed along to us. which made it very difficult for us to see.
So the people involved on a day-to-day basis were not actually asked for problems or told what problems needed to be fixed.
Right. I can identify problems anywhere. You can probably identify problems around the station here. That
there are no problems at WNRN.
Okay. Well, I'll withdraw that then. But, you know, you can have issues that need to be addressed any place. And I think I can speak for every one of the volunteer companies and the career company also, that if you got an issue, let's fix it and move on and be done with it. But, you know, let's not have a solution imposed upon anybody without having a clear definition of the problem.
All right, so what problem was identified by those who do not participate on a day-to-day basis?
None. You see, you have to understand that, according to Ken Boyd, the Board of Supervisors had been mentioning or discussing for a year some sort of fire rescue ordinance. And there are some places in Virginia that have an ordinance. There are some places in Virginia that don't have an ordinance. There's some places in Virginia that contract with their volunteer agencies to provide service, and there are some that don't do anything. And whatever the discussion was, I don't know because I wasn't a party to it, and I'm not aware that any of the volunteer companies were a party to it. They had a work session or a joint meeting of the Board of Supervisors and ACFRAB, where they called in some people from two places that did have an ordinance. And they talked to them, and then later, either the next day or the day after, at a retreat that the board was having, they voted to have a committee established to institute an ordinance. This is the kind of ordinance.
But an ordinance about what? I mean, was the ordinance about, hey, stop, you know, drinking sodas while you're driving and pay more, you know, no cell phone conversation while you're driving the ambulance? Or is it, you know, more like,
global.
Hey, you need more people on the evening shift? Or, you know, what was the ordinance for?
You know, none of that was mentioned. The ordinance, in its final form, would have changed the structure that is supposed to exist now between ACFRAB and the Board of Supervisors. The bylaws of ACFRAB, read it on the county webpage, say that ACFRAB is to advise the Board of Supervisors on fire and rescue-related issues. And what's happened is we've really just been discussing these issues with staff. So we've really not been doing what the bylaws say.
Give me an example of an issue.
Renewal of the city-county fire contract would be an issue, I think.
Okay.
Location of fire stations, performance standards, any
so
of those.
So the board wants to be more heavily involved in this rather than having...
I don't know if they want to be more involved or they want to be less involved. Because, and I don't mean that in a flippant way. It's that it seems to me that the structure of the other ordinance or the final draft ordinance would be that ACFRAB has now established a structure that is going to be a big bureaucracy, and it is tasked with generating all these policies to subject all the member companies to, and if we don't like them, then we tell the chief, and the chief can institute them anyway. If we pass one he didn't like, he can veto it, and then there's a long, laborious appeal process to the Board of Supervisors if somebody's unhappy about that. And that's the draft ordinance that's kind of aging right this minute. And so that kind of changes this. Well, what it does is it institutionalizes what ACFRAB is really doing now, which I don't think any of the ACFRAB members thinks is working, rather than going back and saying, listen, our task is to advise the Board of Supervisors. Let's figure out a way that we can actually do that.
11:52 here with Dayton Haw from the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad, chief since 1994. And there, when I read the minutes from a lot of these meetings, gaps in ambulance coverage was noted many times. What does that mean?
It was. I don't remember seeing that in the minutes.
Well, it might have possible. Been one of the other. I visited this gigantic website with pages and pages and pages of information, response times, gaps in coverage. What would gaps in coverage be?
I guess it would be consistent inability to provide a service by some fire or rescue or
because I lived in the woods on a back road that's not asphalt covered?
I don't know. It could be because you have a volunteer station that's not manned and it takes a while for people to get there and do something. I don't know what they're talking about, but during the strategic planning process, the facilitator asked the chief if they had done a gap analysis, and the answer was no. So, I mean, you can tell an anecdotal story about anything. I like to at least go by some reliable data to do anything, make any decision.
Anecdotal stories are much more entertaining.
I understand that.
And they often prove the point at least one out of a million.
Well, if they're an anecdotal story and you want them to prove a point, they'll prove it a million out of a million times. There, you wouldn't tell the story.
Well, that's true. But that's why I just host the show and I'm not on the expertise side of the microphone. 11:54 here on the wake-up call. Response times.
Yes.
I read something, and this might go to Waldo Jacobs' website, Seville mm-hmm. News, because there were several articles on the website where the Daily Progress had written an article, and it was, linked to that with all the responses that Waldo gets on his site.
Yeah, I think he actually did us during that time period. I think he actually took what would be the most inaccurate set of data you can have and said that there was no response time problem at CARS.
And I believe you're right. It was he did it in two or three different graphs.
Right, right.
So whichever way you like to read your graphs, you could look at it
right.
And tell. But one of the questions that came up, and again, from somewhere, somebody,
mm-hmm. sure.
Said that, hey, what happens if the Crozet fire, rescue squad is forced to shut down? There's nobody out there. What happens if the North Garden Fire Department shuts down? There's nobody out there.
Well, I mean, I guess somebody's going to have to pay somebody to sit out there then. And I can tell you that just based upon the county's own numbers, that if North Garden decided to shut down, it would cost almost $1 million a year in staff costs to staff one engine out of there 24 hours a day. And, of course, they've got more stuff than that down there now, and usually they get more than that out on a call, too, so...
11:56 with Dayton Haw. Just a few moments left. Let me remind you, this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And we want to take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be on for the hour. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746. And at brgtshirts.com. All right, just a few moments left with Dayton, chief of the Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad. Dayton, what are some of the big issues upcoming for whether you view it as just for the rescue squad itself or the rescue squad being one of, I guess, an interlocked, gear of how things work with the city squad, the county squad, the university squad, and the politicians that are involved?
Well, see, we haven't mentioned all the stuff that's going on at a state or national level that makes it more difficult for us to make sure that we can provide the service we provide. We're going on our second iteration of changes in the paramedic and intermediate curriculum now, and neither of them has been helpful to volunteer staffing.
What do you mean?
Well, there's a
requirements for people to be what they're trained on.
Training requirements. We just went through about 2.5 years ago a 72-hour required transition course to take all of us old dogs that were cardiac technicians and make us intermediates. And I remember sitting in the class, and we've got a nurse educator that has been doing it for 25 years. We've got an emergency medicine resident, a critical care nurse. Something flashed up on the screen from the curriculum. And none of the three of them knew what it meant. And I certainly didn't know what it meant. But I can assure you that I'm not sure why it was in the intermediate curriculum, because if the three of them didn't know it, I certainly didn't need to know it to be able to take care of you. And so now we're getting ready to go through that again. We're going to have another 72-hour transition program because of national educational standards for...
Why do they change? I mean, who says... Well,
you want my honest opinion? Yes. I can give my honest opinion.
Please.
Because... people have jobs doing education, and they need to keep their jobs.
They need to show that they are working hard.
That's right.
Thinking about you.
Right.
While thinking about themselves.
Right. They're there to help me.
Yes, and I see that a lot. Yeah. So what, you know, as the chief,
right.
What's on your radar screen, things to worry about, you know, like you don't have enough on a day-to-day basis just doing the schedule and taking care of everybody who needs cared for.
Oh, I can't even get to that. I've gone from spending 90% of my time with my hands taking care of patients to spending 90% of my time in the bureaucracy.
How much of that comes from the city and the county versus the national level?
It varies. It varies by the week. This week it's spent mostly with the county.
Yeah.
The last, you know, 6 or 8 months has been spent mostly with the county. And it'll shift to something else soon, I'm sure. But, I mean, one of the issues is if you're a volunteer agency, you have to make sure that you have trained and qualified volunteers that are there when people need them to be there. And so recruitment and retention and just general ongoing training are of concern to everyone.
And you will take volunteers. They don't have to be trained on how to. They don't have to ride in the truck, right? You have other volunteers who do less intensive medical thing.
We do. We don't have as many of those positions as other departments do, but we do have people that don't do anything other than water rescue. So we have some members that only do water rescue.
I was thinking more administrative, rescue. People who sit around the, makes it sound like they're lazy.
We really don't. I think the only one of those volunteers that we have is Catherine Harding, who does all of our memorial donations, acknowledges them, and takes care of that for us.
Real quick, before Patrick pushes me out of the way.
It looks like he's going to.
He's going to. Contact information for people who are interested, whether it's to volunteer, whether it's to make donations, because this isn't all. There's no charge from CARS to the city or the county.
Right. At www.carsrescue.org.
Charlottesville Albemarle Rescue Squad Chief Dayton Haw here in the studio today. Dayton, thanks so much for coming in.
You're very welcome. My contact information is there. If anybody has a question, please feel free to email me, and I promise I'll respond.
And we'll have this up as a podcast shortly so you can make your comments, and we'll have a link there for Dayton as well. Next week, we'll be talking national politics with Jim Sofka from the Federal Executive Institute. Thanks.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.